You're listening to episode 100 of Bionic Planet, part of my Tribes of the Climate Realm vertical, which I introduced in episode 97, The Mosaic, The Minefield, and A Manifesto. I'm creating these episodes to help you bridge the gap between the realities of climate and biodiversity finance and what you've probably heard in public discourse. Today's show is the first of many, offering you a truer, completer, and more accurate glimpse into the origins of the voluntary carbon market than you've probably ever heard before. This is important because history is who we are and why we are the way we are, as David McCulloch put it. But what is the history of the voluntary carbon market?
Well, originally, the VCS was really about just letting 1,000 flowers bloom.
Mark Stewart is an environmental economist who's been working the climate puzzle for over 3 decades. The VCS he's referring to is the Verified Carbon Standard. Mark Stewart and my other main guest today, Mark Kenber, are founding board members of the VCS, which started germinating in 2005 for several reasons, including
a recognition that governments were moving far more slowly than they should do in addressing climate change. Carbon markets could be a way to at least temporarily fill the gap.
Temporarily fill the gap by driving emissions down deeper and faster than governments were, but also by letting 1,000 flowers bloom, developing and testing new methodologies. These were and are the core objectives of the VCS, although, as you'll see, voluntary carbon standards don't just let those flowers bloom. They cultivate them in ways that aim to ensure long-term survival, in part by constantly updating their practices as they go. It's a lot different from just letting things sprout up. I'm focusing in this series primarily on the VCS and our trees because my heart is in ending deforestation. And those two standards are part of that effort. But all legitimate voluntary carbon standards follow roughly the same procedures. Voluntary carbon markets began in the 1980s as a way of bringing more rigor into philanthropy, as I covered in episode 76 of Bionic Planet, called Six Lessons from 45 Years of Natural Climate Solutions. By the time the VCS began, governments seemed poised to really step up in a big way, and all the talk was about encouraging early action to get things rolling for when governments got their acts together. How naive we were.
Actually, the most fond desire at the outset was that this thing would put itself out of business, you know, that the world would do better things.
But the world failed to do better things, and by 2022, when I conducted today's interviews, the voluntary carbon market stood as the sole functioning mechanism in a landscape of failed policies. To those who built the VCS, this was not a triumph. It was a symptom of larger systemic failure.
Let's not forget that we're here because we failed.
That's Mark Kenber again from our 2022 conversation. And the we he's referencing is the larger climate effort, of which voluntary initiatives are just a part. Anti-market ideologues hate environmental markets because they see them as part of a libertarian plot to undermine governments. And they state this openly, as I pointed out in episode 75. And libertarian ideologues are just as bad. They see effective government programs as a plot to abolish private property. And again, they state this themselves. But none of the people I know leading these voluntary initiatives, whether the voluntary carbon market or zero deforestation pledges, is out to undermine effective policy. In fact, they're usually crying out for more government involvement, although there's legitimate debate over what the role of government should be, and I'll link to a few relevant episodes in the show notes so you can see what I mean. In episode 75, we saw that Kyle Pope of the Columbia Journalism Review pins a lot of the blame for our larger systemic failure on us journalists and our penchant for bright, shiny objects. Stories that contain subtlety, that evolve, that don't have an ending, those aren't our strength, he wrote. And I agree. In that same episode, I warned that while most journalists are trying to understand this stuff, elements of the tabloid press were about to do to climate solutions what they did to climate science. Tragically, I was right. When a few outlets turned their attention to climate solutions, they saw the voluntary carbon market standing tall. Lacking any historical perspective, they decided to try and knock it down.
Man may be unwittingly changing the world's climate through the waste products of his civilization.
There's a group of us now who are proposing that the Earth has actually entered a new epoch, and that is the Anthropocene.
We know that the enemy is carbon, and we know its ugly face. We should put a big fat price on it. And of course, add to that, drop the subsidies.
I'm calling these episodes the Tribes of the Climate Realm to emphasize the fact that the climate community is not a monolithic entity, but is instead something like a disunified realm spread across thousands of contested miles of mountains, plains, and forests, with competing tribes and factions and all the different perspectives, agendas, and intrigue that come with it. Some of these differences reflect valid points where reasonable people can disagree, and there is a legitimate debate over the role of government, the role of the private sector, and the role of civil society in meeting the climate and biodiversity challenges. But too much of what erupts into public discourse is simply disinformation and propaganda. My goal is to cut through the noise, debunk the myths, and focus on the genuine debates surrounding climate issues. And today's history lesson begins almost 20 years ago.
2005 was a pretty important year. It was the year that the Kyoto Protocol came into force. It was the year that the European Emissions Trading Scheme started in earnest. And so that probably marked the point where the idea of market-based instruments to deal with climate change went from something that seemed like a good idea, more of an academic concept, to something that was going to really become real.
The argument for market-based instruments is that they accelerate reductions in part by driving finance to the most cost-effective solutions. The World Bank says that, quote, trading in carbon credits could reduce the cost of implementing nationally determined contributions to the Paris Agreement by more than half. Cutting the cost in half means doubling the reductions per dollar spent, which is one way reductions are accelerated. Some historical context. Countries negotiated the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC, in 1992. That was 13 years after the First World Climate Conference, which took place in 1979. At that meeting, scientists from around the world unanimously agreed that deforestation and changes in land use were two of the three leading sources of greenhouse gas emissions from human activities. It was an unprecedented consensus among scientists from the Soviet Union, the United States, and dozens of other countries across the political spectrum. It took place over 40 years ago. It was well covered in publications like Nature, Scientific American, and The Ecologist, but it barely registered a blip in popular media who had bigger fish to fry. After all, 1979 was the year Sony introduced the Walkman, McDonald's introduced the Happy Meal, and actor John Wayne died. These were all among the 10 biggest news stories that year. There was serious news, too. There was the Iranian Revolution, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and Pope John Paul II's visit to Poland. All were important stories, and they all had two advantages over the climate crisis. One, they were photogenic, and two, they were pretty easy to cover. So, negotiations and scientific conferences unfolded invisibly over the ensuing 13 years, until the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The UNFCCC emerged from the Rio Earth Summit, and it's a global agreement to reduce greenhouse gas emissions over time. It's a framework convention that built on scores of other treaties and agreements, including the Vienna Convention and Montreal Protocol, both of which focused on ozone-depleting substances, and the Brundtland Commission, which introduced the concept of common but differentiated responsibilities that became a cornerstone of the framework convention. That meant that it recognized all countries' share of responsibility to meet global challenges, but that some countries have contributed more to the problems than others have, and that different countries have different capabilities. The UNFCCC is called a framework convention because it provides a framework within which we take further action over time. It establishes principles for international cooperation on climate change, and it keeps us all on the same page, but it doesn't magically fix the whole mess all at once. Nothing does. The objective is to build a global mosaic of interlocking but probably imperfect solutions where the whole is bigger than the sum of the parts. Over the next 5 years, from 1992 to 1997, countries negotiated the Kyoto Protocol that Mark Kenber mentioned earlier. The Kyoto Protocol sat inside the Framework Convention and set binding targets for industrialized countries, but not for developing countries, mostly because of the common but differentiated responsibilities that I mentioned earlier. The Kyoto Protocol included the Clean Development Mechanism, or CDM, which was a market-based system for making companies in rich countries pay for clean development in poor countries. It worked by putting a cap on industrial emissions in developed countries, but letting companies offset part of their emissions by financing things like wind farms, solar power, and hydropower plants in poor countries. It did not finance sustainable farming and forest protection, despite the fact that deforestation and changes in land use generate a third of all greenhouse gas emissions associated with human activities. For me and other members of my tribe, that's an egregious failure. So, how did forest protection and sustainable farming get left out of the Kyoto Protocol? Well, the protocol itself was agreed in 1997, but the rules for implementing it weren't agreed until 2001 in Marrakesh, Morocco, the so-called Marrakesh Accords.
So Kyoto in 97 was agreed, and like many international agreements, a lot was left open. I mean, the parallel is the Paris Agreement in 2015, and then you have what happened in Glasgow, which was the rule book around Article 6, the trading part of the Paris Agreement. So absolutely analogous process. In 2001, the Marrakesh Accords were agreed, and then everything came into force 4 years later. In the Marrakesh Accords, a lot of what the NGO community been asking for in terms of standards around sustainable development and so on were lost in the final negotiations.
NGOs had been experimenting with forest protection and sustainable farming for decades, and scientists operating through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, had identified broad consensus on how to measure the impact of human actions on forests and estimate future deforestation risk through the emerging science of land change modeling, which we'll examine in later episodes. Unfortunately, the tribes of the climate realm engaged in a massive ideological battle ahead of Marrakesh. It's one I alluded to in episodes 49 and 76, and I'll revisit it in this series. When it was over, forest protection and sustainable agriculture were left out of the Marrakesh Accords.
There was a de minimis that was left afterwards.
This is Mark Stewart again. Within the climate community, he's known for co-founding a company called Eco Securities in 1997, together with Pedro Moracosta, who he'll mention in a bit and we'll hear more about later. He also helped Costa Rica develop the world's first forest carbon protocol, also in 1997.
We were working with the Costa Ricans on their national program with the World Bank and other things throughout 1997 going up to Kyoto. Many people had assumed that there was going to be, you know, a forestry window of some variety or another in carbon markets, but the Europeans were extremely focused on having hard numeric targets, and the Americans were extremely focused on having flexible mechanisms, and the compromise that occurred was they would have both of those, but the thing that got dropped out of that was RED in particular.
The acronym RED didn't exist back then, but it stands for Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation. Check out episodes 48, 49, and 50 to learn how it eventually ended up in the Paris Agreement. Also, if you appreciate Bionic Planet and want more and better episodes, you can help me deliver them by becoming a patron at patreon.com/bionicplanet. That's patreon.com/bionicplanet. Bionic Planet there is all one word, no dots or dashes. I'm producing this show on my own time and my own dime, and I can't afford to keep it going if I don't get more support. Anyway, RED was left out of the Marrakesh Accords, and therefore out of the Kyoto Protocol. But afforestation and reforestation made the cut, at least in theory.
The afforestation, reforestation protocols, I think, as you could see under the CDM, virtually none of it ever happened.
It never happened because under the CDM, afforestation, reforestation credits were only granted temporary status. They had to be renewed every few years because trees don't last forever, and there was debate over how to deal with that. But there was also an ideological rift, one that goes to the core of why I'm calling this series The Tribes of the Climate Realm.
So again, while there was a window for that, everybody's analysis was it was just non-economic versus all the other emission mitigation options that were out there. So again, it really went into stasis at that point for really close to a decade.
Yeah, it was that long. I think the reasons that forestry had been excluded were fundamentally the reasons you've just mentioned. There was a lot of pressure from the NGO community, who I think at that time, many, and I probably include myself in that, felt that if it doesn't hurt, then it's not making progress.
If it doesn't hurt, then it's not making progress. That's the argument for a high compliance price on carbon, and it makes sense. We're talking about carrots and sticks here. The voluntary carbon market is about carrots. It's a way to entice companies into going beyond what's required by law. In 2001, biologist Philip Fearnside, then with Brazil's National Institute of Amazonian Research, analyzed the disparate views and found that opposition to including forests in the CDM came almost exclusively from a small cluster of European NGOs or their affiliates in some developing countries, while support for including forests in the CDM came from NGOs based in the United States or in countries facing high rates of deforestation, primarily Brazil. The reasons for these differences are not scientific, despite the debate frequently being couched in scientific terms, he wrote. It is very important to distinguish between what is a scientific conclusion and what is a moral judgment.
And some of the concerns were legitimate. These are apocryphal stories, but there were people who were reportedly trying to claim planting trees between the cars in a car park would count it as a forest, and all sorts of things like that, which may or may not have been true. But that sort of course was red rag to the NGO bull and kind of campaigned for no sinks in the CDM, as it was called at the time. But a lot of companies were interested in something that would protect their reputation, ensure that they were investing in projects and programs that were high integrity. And that was the genesis of the gold standard.
So, negotiators failed to implement standards and procedures that environmental NGOs wanted, and some companies began moving beyond what the law required. Here I should reiterate again something I alluded to a few minutes ago, but I just want to make it clear. Carbon markets are broadly divided into two spheres. Compliance markets, which are used to enforce the law, voluntary markets, which are designed to encourage action above what's legally required and to test new methodologies that might not be ready for compliance markets. Voluntary markets are not and never were envisioned as a replacement for policy or compliance markets. They are not the product of a libertarian fever dream, but are a tool for encouraging action beyond what the law requires and testing new methodologies. Voluntary activities have been taking place for over a century, as we saw in episode 22. There, I trace the genesis of the Consumer Goods Forum to the aftermath of World War I, when French food merchants began implementing quality controls on imported food products. Mark Kenber mentioned the gold standard, which he helped create. It also has two spheres. The CDM gold standard layers additional criteria onto projects certified under the CDM, while the voluntary gold standard exists to encourage action beyond what's required by law, or in countries that have no caps. In 2004, Kenber joined the Climate Group, a UK think tank formed to fix the narrative on climate change.
Our goal was to change the way people thought and talked about climate change from one of disaster, catastrophe, and despair to a narrative around opportunity. So all our work was based in one way or another on demonstrating that companies, cities, and states and regions that took leadership action on climate change outperformed their peers, whether it's in profits or market share or more votes or whatever it happens to be, better quality of life. And so we published a whole bunch of reports called Carbon Down, Profits Up, which was examples of companies that had gone beyond Kyoto and made money as a result. So it was kind of trying to shift the narrative from one of, hey, look, don't be scared of climate change. Think of this as your next big business opportunity.
To me, this wasn't just about creating a narrative, which is a marketing thing, but about mainstreaming the true narrative. The fact is that we really should be approaching this as a business opportunity and doing so in a way that is fair and equitable.
Fast forward to 2005 and market-based instruments are gaining traction. People are beginning to see that they are a way both of accelerating climate action for companies in particular to voluntarily engage with climate action, but also a recognition that governments were moving far more slowly than they should do in addressing climate change. Carbon markets could be a way to at least temporarily fill the gap.
Mark will say very clearly his most fond desire at the outset was that this thing would put itself out of business, that the world would do better things.
Well, I still say that now. When I give speeches about voluntary carbon markets, my first line is, let's not forget that we're here because we failed. We've been negotiating international climate change since 1987, 1988. We had a framework convention in 1992 where, remember, rich countries promised to stabilize their emissions by year 2000 and so on and so forth. And we shouldn't be relying on voluntary action now. But the fact that we are, we still need things like VCS, like Vera, like the work that's continuing, because that's got to plug a gap that we collectively have failed to fill.
Well, I think the interesting thing, building on what you're saying, Mark, is that was how you and many of us saw it back then.
That new voice is Toby Jensen-Smith, who joined the conversation late. These interviews, by the way, were actually an impromptu discussion we had in a Washington, D.C. restaurant the day after a Vera staff meeting, where the focus was on how they were adapting to the challenge of being an institution rather than just the transitional initiative we're talking about here.
I think now, in a way, as we were discussing last night, there's this potential to actually, through the nimbleness and innovation and scaling now of the voluntary carbon market, to actually start to fill some additional gaps in policy arenas. And I think in that way, it could be very complementary. So it could be now it's just morphing into something that's bigger and taking over more roles.
I totally agree with you. I think it's beyond that. Because there was such a lull between the perceived end of the Kyoto Protocol first phase and the Paris Agreement, the voluntary carbon market enabled development, or provided the impetus for development of a whole bunch of technologies that are now fundamental for monitoring, reporting, and verification, different ways of calculating carbon content, all that's a lot of scientific work that was driven by a market need that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So I think it's made a huge contribution.
It was a life raft that a lot of people kept one hand on while waiting for something good to happen.
So, the voluntary carbon market was a life raft, a testing ground, and a way to fill in gaps. That's kind of how I saw Bionic Planet when I launched it in 2016, a way of helping people understand nature-based climate solutions in the wake of the Paris Agreement, which I saw being roundly misunderstood. I started Bionic Planet long before natural climate solutions became trendy, and I've continued as they've come under unjust attack. I'm now in season 9, and no one can accuse me of going for the easy stuff. We're about 20 minutes into the show, and I have a couple questions for you. First, do you like it? Do you want to hear more and better episodes? Second, what kind of people do you think are here with us, listening along? Do you think they're the kind of people you want to reach? Because if you represent an ethical business seeking to connect with a global, environmentally conscious audience and align your brand with plain talk on sticky issues, then reach out to me at steve@bionic-planet.com. That's steve@bionic-planet.com to learn how you can become a sponsor of the show. That's steve@bionic-planet.com. I'm looking for sponsors who share my mission of cutting through the bunk and propaganda around climate and biodiversity finance to push the real debates into the public sphere. I'm looking for people who believe in countering propaganda with truth and not just countervailing propaganda. You won't find Greenpeace debating the Cato Institute on Bionic Planet, because they'll just be hurling slogans at each other. I mean, that stuff is entertaining, but it gets you nowhere. So if you're an ethical company or foundation that shares my mission of unpacking complex and emotionally charged issues for people outside the climate echo chamber, and you want to grow with me as my audience grows, then reach out to me at steve@bionic-planet.com. I'm also recognized as a 501c3 nonprofit through a partnership with Manga Bay, so larger donations are tax deductible. Now back to Mark Kenber, who was talking about companies that were looking to move forward with climate solutions as governments floundered.
As companies started thinking this, they were seeing that while the gold standard was one part of the market, something was needed that would cover the market as a whole, that would guarantee, and I think at that time what people were looking for, and Mark, you were in the market at the time, were looking for something that said across all projects and across all geographies, a ton is a ton. And so you create a fungible unit that would guarantee to buyers that an organization with reasonable integrity that had brought together lots of stakeholders were going to say, this is good enough.
Let's unpack this, because he said a few things there that really need to be amplified. First, he talked about fungibility, the need to come as close as possible to saying that a ton of emissions reduced in, say, forestry is the same as a ton reduced in the industrial sector. This is what a standard is all about. And it's what happened again in 2020 when Canadian economist Mark Carney, then serving as governor of the Bank of England, launched the Task Force on Scaling Voluntary Carbon Markets, which eventually became the Integrity Council for the Voluntary Carbon Market, or ICVCM. I served on the task force, and the emphasis was on scaling by developing core carbon principles, which is exactly what Mark Kember was talking about in 2005. Within the task force, that desire came from the tech and banking sectors and not from the scientific community. A lot of the people making the demand were new to the carbon space and had no idea how difficult it was to achieve core carbon principles. And I felt there was a lot of reinvention of old wheels, as I covered in episode 64 called Race to Zero, Meet the Task Force on Scaling Voluntary Carbon Markets. The effort to scale without losing rigor then became characterized as an effort to bring integrity into the markets. It's a characterization that's misleading because it implied there was no integrity before, which is not the case, as you'll see in this series. Some critics have also mischaracterized the ton-is-a-ton aspiration, contrasting it with uncertainties and probabilities in the modeling that was eventually incorporated into the standards. Such critiques are straight out of the Science Denial Handbook, as we saw in episode 77, called Where Does Healthy Critique End and Cynical Denial Begin? I won't delve into the whole topic of uncertainties and probabilities now, but it's a theme I will return to over and over in the future if I get the support I need to keep this show going. Fungibility and core carbon principles and a ton being a ton are all worthy aspirations because in order to drive down emissions most effectively, we need to find ways for people in hard-to-abate sectors to finance reductions in easier-to-abate sectors. That means being able to reasonably say that a ton of emissions reduced in the forestry sector roughly equates to a ton reduced in the transport sector, and that uncertainties are factored in to err on the side of being conservative, while everything updates over time as uncertainties diminish. Keep in mind that science is not about absolutes. It's about a preponderance of the evidence and the concurrent views of most experts, especially when you have social science layered on top of physical sciences, as is the case with carbon accounting. You will never get unanimous agreement in such a situation, so we look for the sweet spot where most experts align. Anyway, looping back to 2005, Kember was at the Climate Group, and NGOs were trying to fill gaps in the CDM. I was still in mainstream media, but beginning to work with a new initiative called Ecosystem Marketplace. When we produced the first State of Voluntary Carbon Markets report, we identified more than a dozen voluntary standards in various states of development, but with no consistency or comparability among them. That's when Kember decided to send out a survey to environmental NGOs, academic institutions, and industry groups to see if there was an appetite for supporting these proliferating efforts with unified rules.
The starting point was, can we create CDM without the bureaucracy? So are there ways of cutting a whole lot of fat out of the CDM processes while maintaining at least the same level of rigor? And so lots of the questionnaire and the survey was, one, is this necessary? And two, how do we do it? What are things we must keep? What can we not keep? Where can we be more flexible in the CDM? And then some things like, should we use the CDM processes like accreditation of VVBs and a whole bunch of things.
VVBs are validation and verification bodies, which at the time were independent auditors certified under the United Nations. The VCS would eventually go on to adopt that same system. Kember received over 100 responses from scores of individuals stating that yes, there was a need for unified rules, but there was no agreement on whose rules they should follow. The idea soon became an agenda item at climate meetings around the world. And by 2006, the VCS was getting buy-in from NGOs, but not from the private sector. Kember reached out to the International Emissions Trading Association, or IETA, for input from those emitters most likely to use credits. This led to a more structured approach involving diverse but loose and self-funded steering committees, but it also raised the hackles of those NGOs that see industry as the enemy and the root of all evil, a theme we explored in episode 75. There is, however, a kind of symbiotic relationship between the activist NGOs and those seeking solutions, something of a good cop, bad cop thing, and there was a bit of that at play here.
There was beginning to be pressure on companies that weren't covered by regulation, and then in countries that didn't have strong regulations, such as at the time the US and Australia, companies who wanted to go further, recognized that it was an important calling card if you want to operate in global markets, there were reputational risks, but also didn't want to just buy credits from the Clean Development Mechanism because it was perceived to be politicized, bureaucratic, slow, and with expensive because of high transaction costs.
All those things were true.
And so one of the things that we tried to do was to create something that had at least as much rigor as the CDM, but with a lot less bureaucracy. The second was to really galvanize action or catalyze action in the voluntary market. And the third, which is in a way ironic given the work that the Integrity Council for the Voluntary Carbon Market is doing now, was my intention, having been very closely involved in the creation of the gold standard, was that VCS would be a threshold standard. Yeah. The standard that says this is a genuinely additional real ton of carbon reduction. And then you could build other things on it. So the gold standard could have built its criteria. There was an outfit called Social Carbon. Mm-hmm. There were the conservation community benefit people, which Toby Jansen-Smith was involved in, which was another thing you could build on top. And the idea is this would probably be the basis, and then mm-hmm. you'd have different flavors. So this was guaranteed the ice cream was ice cream, and then other people would bring different flavors of ice cream to it.
Well, at the outset, VCS had approved other standards, such mm-hmm. as CDM, obviously, and CAR was one of the other ones. And that was an interesting thing that sort of eventually fell by the wayside, I assume.
Sadly, and there are multiple reasons for that. No one wanted to be part of somebody else's standard. The environmental community, I don't think, is different from any other community in that we spend our mornings sharpening our elbows and not invented here syndrome, which is something that's plagued us for as long as I've been working in this sector.
And it was really contentious. I remember sitting in some of those side events, and I remember one in particular where Nicola Steen was practically in tears because she thought smallholders were going to be locked out, it was going to become too complicated. We're going to recreate the problems of the CDM. And then others were saying, no, we go too far the other way. It'll be meaningless. I mean, it seemed to me, at least, later?
I think it was then from people who had ideologically driven positions about market-based instruments, full stop. Okay. And then later as the rules emerged. And actually many of the complaints then are still complaints now that it's the transaction costs involved with emission reduction or removal projects are high, and that therefore excludes smaller projects in poorer countries with weaker legal and financial systems. And there are developers who work on those kind of projects, but across the board, we haven't really resolved that yet.
At the time, the CDM was absolutely terrible for small projects. They eventually created a window for smaller types of projects, and that was only marginally successful. But I remember during the steering committee days, there was a strong faction within it that was really trying to create essentially almost a positive list, as it were, for certain types of project. You know, that was a major point of contention between various folks, which was, you know, are we really supporting development focused activities, or are we really focused on environmental integrity? Because there is a trade-off there. Again, we tried to thread the needle, but it was really probably one of the biggest points of controversy in the whole 18-month steering committee or whatever long it was roughly 18-month steering committee process.
Within a few months, the endeavor had begun to snowball, but the participants were deep and not broad. They needed help in handling the responses they were getting, but they also needed more input from the business community, which, contrary to what you may have read in the tabloids, didn't concoct these markets in some little dark hole, but they had to be drawn in. In addition to AIDA, Canberra also reached out to the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, or WCSD, and the World Economic Forum, or WEF, which we often just call the WEF.
The climate group was doing it on its own, and we were an outfit that was only 2 years old. No one knew who we were. And if this was going to have traction, then we needed to partner with organizations that had presence. And so we hooked up with AIETA, WBCSD, and WEF, and mainly AIETA in terms of being active. And Andre Mark, who was then the executive director of AIETA, and involving three other big organizations with their own governance, meant that it was a slower process. But that was a good thing, because it meant we put the document out for consultation. And it also meant that we really had to chew over the big issues. And we formed the steering committee, and even the formation of the steering committee was a politically contentious process. The business folks didn't want this to be NGO dominated. I didn't want it to be dominated by businesses who were looking to feather their own nests, as I thought at the time. And so we've had this balance, and actually
it came out pretty well that there was representation from every sector. No single group could outvote the others.
Yep.
And we settled quite quickly. Although there were heated moments, we had a very clear sense of what we were trying to achieve. And we argued every issue to death and then came to an agreement on it.
This diversity is critical. They wanted everyone at the table. Governmental agencies, non-governmental organizations, and the companies that would be the buyers of these things. That again infuriated some of the purists who see industry as the enemy, which I get. Some say we can't include oil companies in the solution. Others say we have to include them. But everyone agrees we can't let them run the show. This next passage is a bit garbled because I caught up to Mark Kember again via Zoom to flesh a few things out.
BP was certainly involved. So it wasn't just NGOs, but it certainly wasn't just businesses either. The project was managed out of the climate group where I was. Once we saw that there was appetite for this, we brought together AITA and Andre Marcou at the time was very deeply involved in it. There were various godparents of it, but WEF and WBCSD were very much sort of second tier co-owners. We brought them in partly because of their networks and their reputation, and because they brought businesses, but it wasn't their core thing, whereas obviously for AITA it was. And Andre and I had a tense and often fractious love-hate relationship, which we now laugh about a lot. I think both probably wanted to own it, and I didn't entirely trust Andre, and he probably didn't entirely trust me. He thought, oh, Mark's this sort of enviro guy, what the hell does he know about it? And I thought Andre's in hot to the oil and gas sector, not having him anywhere near it. And it turned out to be creative tension, even if at times it didn't feel like it.
We had meetings during the year in Geneva, in London, in New York. The
final one was in New York and Washington. Yeah.
Washington. I mean, there were six subgroups. I'm trying to remember which the six groups. There was one on registries, one on methodologies, one on certifiers and verifiers. I'm trying to remember what they all were, but
Each of us was on
two groups, as I recall. And so you were in different permutations with the groups, which made it interesting because you sort of would get a little bit of the taste of what was going on in the other groups, even while you were in these meetings. And again, it was an intensive 18 months.
As the effort gathered steam, participants decided to start with low-hanging fruit, industrial projects like wind farms and solar institutions, where there were plenty of lessons learned in the CDM experience. Deforestation, they knew, was important, but it was politically contentious, and they didn't want to whip up the same ideological frenzy that had derailed Marrakesh. Now, deforestation and unsustainable farming are classic wicked problems, which means they are, by definition, symptoms of a myriad of other problems, such as poverty, education, or, increasingly, climate change itself. Deep-pocketed agribusinesses can and should be fined or regulated into compliance. But the lion's share of deforestation comes from smallholders struggling to feed their families. They're acting out of desperation, not greed. And they need to be helped, not harangued. You might remember Marco Cerezo from episode 78. In 2005, he was struggling to slow deforestation in Guatemala by stringing together small grants and aid packages that lasted at longest 3 years.
If you want to do community development, if you want to do large-scale conservation, if you want to build sustainable landscapes, very soon you realize small grants and medium grants will not get you there. And that's where, after 15 years of working in conservation and, you know, really running after the next small grant to survive, we realized that this was unsustainable and we needed other mechanisms.
So the need for climate finance was clear, and the biggest mechanism for delivering it had failed. Toby Jensen-Smith was working for Conservation International at the time, but he was running the Community Conservation and Biodiversity, or CCB, standards, which a consortium of NGOs had put together. He remembers when he first heard that this promising new initiative, then called the Voluntary Carbon Standard, was going to launch without incorporating forest conservation and sustainable farming, technically referred to in the IPCC as agriculture, forestry, and other land uses, or AFALU.
I remember I was at Conservation International. I saw that announcement, or somehow found out that AFALU and ag and forest were not going to be in, or that was the plan. And immediately at that point, I saw, gosh, this is going to be a huge, major missed opportunity, because the European Emissions Trading Scheme had kept out forests. The Kyoto Protocol had just temporary credits for afforestation, reforestation that wasn't really working. And so me, with my sort of biodiversity and forest conservation hat on and wanting to use market mechanisms to save these forests, was like, this is our opportunity. If the VCS as looking like becoming the major global voluntary standard, if that does not include forests, it might be game over, or at least game delayed for many years.
Yeah.
And if it does include it, it's going to be an amazing opportunity and precedent to show how that's possible and inform regulatory regimes and scale. So at that point, Mark, I reached out, found out you were behind this, reached out to you. I remember actually some, you know, how these memories come back. I was in Golden Gate Park, and you were like, well, not sure, maybe the Ken and other input of like forests can't be done, let's wait. And basically, we got to the point where you said, we might consider it if you could help create a fungible unit, which basically meant you had to address permanence because you couldn't have a temporary credit. So at that point, basically said, Mark, we can do that. Let me see what we can do, and then we'll talk some more. So that was the beginning. And once Mark said there was this opportunity, if we could solve the permanence and fungibility issue, then I started reaching out to other NGOs and first mobilizing and getting people aware how important this was so that people weighed in. I don't know how full your inbox got, but conservation NGOs, but there was a lot of, I think, pressure then building to the VCS saying this was important and we needed that signal. And then it was, how do you do it? Which we can talk about in a minute. But is that right, Mark?
I think that's about right. And it's, what's interesting is a lot of kind of organizations that have mixed message amongst themselves. Some of the big conservation groups, their climate team said in the old school, no sinks in the CDM. When I was involved in the gold standard in the climate negotiations, I was working for WWF, which at the time the forest team wanted carbon money to protect forests, and the climate team thought this was a loophole. But then also the level of individuals. So I, having come from that WWF perspective, were thinking no sinks in the CDM, but my boss at the climate group, Steve Howard, was one of the early members of the Forest Stewardship Council and had previously worked with the Tropical Forest Trust, and thought, yes, this is a real interesting opportunity to finance forest conservation and buffer zone restoration and so on and so forth.
And so then after Mark gave the signal that VCS might be open to considering ag and forests if the permanence issue could be addressed, then basically I went around and talked to all the smartest people in the space, like Ken Newcomb and Sandra Brown and Bernard Schlamendinger, Pedro Morricosta, and said, how should we do this? How can we do this?
The answers came from decades of trial, error, and adjustment, generating reams of papers evaluated and synthesized under the IPCC, as well as from new research on the quantification of forest risks being aggregated under Windrock, and a new buffer concept that we will explore in subsequent episodes, assuming I get the support I need to keep them going. If this is all new to you, well, there's a reason no one has reported this stuff before. It's hard and it's time-consuming, but it's important. Nothing happening now in this space, whether you're talking about the Science Based Targets Initiative, the ICVCM, the Nature Positive Movement, or any of the other myriad climate and biodiversity solutions, whether voluntary or compliance, will make sense if you don't know where we came from and what lessons we can learn from the past. I opened with a quote from historian David McCulloch, but it was philosopher George Santayana who more famously said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." I'll add that you can't remember what you haven't heard. And if you think I'm doing a good job of helping people learn the past, the present, and the future of climate and biodiversity finance, and if you're enjoying the show and want to see it grow with even better episodes, you can make a big difference. Start by giving us a 5-star review on your favorite podcatcher, because the more stars I get, the more ears I get. And the more ears we get, the more minds we can reach. And we have to reach hundreds of millions of minds if we're to meet the climate challenge. Beyond that, consider becoming a patron at patreon.com. That's patreon.com/bionicplanet. Your support means the world to us. You can also become a sponsor of Bionic Planet by reaching out to me at steve@bionic-planet.com. That's steve@bionic-planet.com. I'm accepting sponsorships for individual episodes as well as verticals, but I'm really looking for organizations that believe in telling the true, full story of climate and biodiversity finance, and who want to partner with me as I tell that story based on decades of experience and an informed, as opposed to biased, perspective. I think we can all agree that if we don't get the money right, we won't get anything right, and we can't let ideologues, outliers, and opportunists dictate the narrative. That address again is steve@bionic-planet.com. That's steve@bionic-planet.com. And that wraps up today's show. Until next time, I'm Steve Zwick in Chicago. Thanks for listening.